He's the office Nimrod who ripped his pants, screwed up every assignment he was handed, and yet somehow was married to Christy Brinkley. He played Jerry Gergich, a.k.a. Larry, a.k.a. Gary, on Parks and Recreation. He's Jim O'Hare. I'm Jerry Strauss, and this is The Laugh Track.
Do you need your weekly comedy fix? Relax while we visit the sitcoms you love, the jokes you remember, the characters you will never forget, and the stars that bring them to you. Sit back. It's The Laugh Track with Jerry Strauss.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to The Laugh Track with Jerry Strauss. He is I am him, and you're here. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us again this week. We are having such a great time here on the show, and we're excited about where we've been, where we're going. Lots of great interviews with your favorite shows, one of which I believe has just soared in popularity, not only since it went off the air a few years ago, but especially this year here in 2020, during these uncertain times, if you will, the pandemic, of course, lots of anxiety, lots of stress, lots of negative emotions out in the world. This show's the perfect antidote, man. If you have never watched Parks and Recreation, go to Netflix or go to the Peacock Network, wherever it may be, and binge it. It's an easy watch, and it's one of those shows that will make you laugh and make you feel good and make you love the cast of characters that it brings to you. One of which we talked to here this week, Jim O'Hare. Of course, you know him as Jerry Gergich, Gary Gergich, Larry Gergich. His name changes several times throughout the course of the series. I hope that's not a spoiler, but certainly a guy who was a big part of the reason that Parks and Rec is such a hilarious program. You're going to love it. You're going to love him. And we got a chance to get lots of insight into being a part of this amazing show and being Jerry. I know a little bit about what it's all about to be Jerry, but this is a different Jerry, a very different Jerry. And we get to hear all about it. So cool. So great. Please. We know all of you. If you're not Parks and Rec fans, you at least know some, because the show has just become such a monster, such a monster, such a quotable show. So if you have people in your life, friends, family, whoever, who like Parks and Rec, pass this interview on to them. Send them the link. Invite them to subscribe to our podcast. Go to our website at laughtrackpod.com and invite them in, because this is a great way to get to know what we do here on The Laugh Track. And a great time is had by all as I hang out with Jim O'Hare from Parks and Rec right here on The Laugh Track. You know, it's funny, we've been talking about this a lot on the show, that this is such an interesting time to be doing a weekly show about TV comedies and about sitcoms, especially classics that people go back and watch again and again. And I see it more on social media, people talking about how watching these types of shows are helping them get through this, helping with anxiety, because it's something that it's comfortable for them. Maybe they've seen these shows a lot before. They know what's coming. They don't have to worry about any, you know, high stakes or drama. They're just familiar things that they can laugh at and take their mind off of things. Parks and Rec, I think, has to be at the top of that list as far as a feel-good anxiety killer. Do you feel like, do you get feedback from the world that, yeah, this is the time for us to enjoy this show?
Every single day. And what I love so much about that is I have shows. I've been a TV guy since I was a little kid. It was all about the television. And then as I got older, you know, the Dick Van Dyke, I mean, I'm much older than you. I'm almost 35. So I
have, wow.
I don't know. What's the laughter about? I don't get it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Interesting. Hurtful. Appropriate, but interesting. Anyway, no. So I was, you know, Dick Van Dyke, Mary Tyler Moore, Oh my God, you know, all the classic, All in the Family, Newhart. Though I just love, have always loved sitcoms and all that stuff. So it's so weird for me because I have my shows. I have my go-to shows that they just need to be on in the background. I don't need to see them. As long as I hear them, it brings me peace. It helps me. And it's, I am always blown away that I'm one actor, whatever. It's all such a gamble to get on a show. And I ended up on a show that has that effect on other people. I love that. I ended up on a show that people can turn to when anxiety is high and they just need just a little something to, settle them down. And I love that I'm on a show that does that. I hear it every day from people. And the thing that's crazy about Parks is we have become more popular now than when we did the show, which is crazy. I don't think that happens all that often, but it did happen here because I don't know if you know the history of Parks, but we were going to be canceled every year. We fought that battle every single year to the point where on May upfronts or where they announce everything that's going to happen, what's being picked up, what's being canceled. And we would all be on our phones texting, have you heard? What have you heard? What have you heard? This went on every year, except for the last two. We did know we were coming back, which, boy, for an actor to know when you leave in March that you're coming back in August, it's a good feeling. It's a good feeling. So, but anyway, I'm jumping your question. But, yeah, so people do tell me that all the time, that it is one of their go-to shows. They don't need to necessarily even see it. Just having it on in the background brings them comfort.
That's amazing. And it's, it's one of the reasons I think not to start at the end before the beginning, but it's one of the reasons why I think your reunion special that you did towards the beginning of the pandemic was so impactful, because it was exactly the kind of feel good familiarity that the world needed, especially at that point when things were still new and people were still, I think, a lot more nervous and anxious about what lockdown was going to look like and what quarantine was going to be. And this was you guys, the characters that they've grown to love over, not just from when the show was on, but like you said, so much more after the fact. And now it's okay, we're seeing them in the same situation that we're going to be in, and we can all kind of laugh about it and have a moment about it and feel good like we do when we watch Parks.
I think the timing of that special was perfect. And, the way it came to be was NBC apparently got a hold of Mike Shore, who co-created with Greg Daniels Parks and Rec, and said, these food banks are in trouble. We're trying to come up with ideas what we can do to do fundraisers, to help the food banks. And so they were trying to get shows to do table reads, and a lot of shows were doing that, which is great. I mean, anything to raise the money, whatever it takes. So then Mike is going back and forth with all of us. And then he said, you guys, I have an idea. Hold on. I'll get back to you. And then I'm going to guess it was 48 hours. And then there was the next message. Hey guys, what do you think about doing a new one? And we were like, damn, yes. So then he said, okay, let me get back to you again. He roped together the old team, and these geniuses, because I think they are geniuses, put together that pandemic episode, not having a clue how they were going to shoot it, how it was going to happen. No one knew anything. He said, would you guys all be willing to donate your salaries? And NBC will then, I don't know if they matched us or put their own chunk, however it worked, but everybody, of course, was immediately, yes, of course, whatever we can do. And then next thing you know, they said, okay, here's our script. And we did a table read, a Zoom table read, laughed our asses off. And next thing you know, they're telling us how they're going to piece it together. And I, Jim O'Hare, is a tech dummy, like the worst. So I'm thinking, I'm going to screw this up. I know would be a good Jerry move, because Jerry would screw it up. But this is Jim O'Hare shooting this damn thing. So they sent us cameras and lights and all boxed up and wiped down. A man delivered it. Then we did it. And then you set it up. And then you put your Zoom camera so they could watch us and direct us and talk us through the piecing of things. And then they scheduled each of us like a block of time. I think mine was 2 or 3 hours on a Tuesday morning. And the funny part was, you know, it all takes place at night. So that I had to be my own grip. I'm putting up my house. I'm in LA, so it's very bright. And I have a ranch style house with a lot of glass, and it's not a Jerry house. So they're like, well, where can we go? I go, well, I have an office on the other side that doesn't have as much glass, but it was daytime. So I ended up having to put dog beds up against the window from the outside, held up by ladders. I mean, it was the most ridiculous thing ever, but it worked. And I ended up with a dark room. And then they talked me through it. They would tell me, okay, you're going to hit the record button now. And then you would give the countdown. I mean, it was nuts. It was ridiculous and yet really cool. I always say, I keep telling people, the minute they said, okay, Jim, we got everything we need, I felt like 1,000 pounds off my shoulders because I was just sure I've screwed this up. I was sure of it. And then they say to me, okay, put it back in the box. There's a guy waiting outside. I go, what? Yes, we got to start editing now. Next thing you know, I pack it all up. I set it in the driveway. I open the gate and a man comes in and he takes the box away. I mean, it was amazing. It was amazing. And they did some trickery, you know, with editing to make it, you know, look better than I certainly did. And I just think it came out really well for the circumstances. Again, they didn't know how they were going to do it. But they kind of, I think they did a great job. And the writing of the episode itself was so, I don't know, it's such a fan pleaser because each character got those moments that people love about them. You know, Jerry goofed up with the, you know, with the emojis and things. He didn't know what the hell he was doing. And just wonderful, sweet moments for all of us. And I don't know. I was always blown away from on Parks. And believe me, people could argue this with me because some would say, well, I don't believe that. And that's their call. I believe Parks and Recreation got better every single season. Like some people I'm sure will go, well, no, those last couple, I disagree. And I think the reason it stayed as strong and kept getting stronger was because Mike Schur, he never left us. So we always had his voice. And I don't know if people know this, but once a show becomes a big hit, a lot of times, people start going other directions because the network's like, oh, okay, give us this now. And now give me a sitcom about this or they pitch ideas that get picked up. So they go, it happens all the time. I mean, Mike Schur and Greg Daniels left The Office for a little while to come to Parks. I mean, it happens. It's the nature of the biz, but Mike never left us, even though he started with Dan Gore, one of the Parks people, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Mike stayed with us. Dan went to Brooklyn. So we never lost his voice. And I, in my opinion, that's why we stayed as strong as we did.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, you know, you touched on a good thing as far as that special goes about the fan service. And this was, it was a special that you guys did that, first of all, I agree, genius in how seamless it came off. It didn't seem like there were any hurdles. It just seemed like it was, you know, everything was done for a reason. Everything yeah. looked great. Everything sounded great. And it just, you know, it was a worthy Parks and Rec episode. And as great as it would be for anybody to tune in and watch that show, maybe who were not familiar with Parks and Rec, for those who were, it was a dose of each and every one of the characters that they grew to fall in love with over those years.
I agree. Yeah, and then even the guest stars, to start off with Bobby Newport, you know, yeah. Paul Rudd, was, because first of all, I didn't even know that had happened, because that was not in the script. So apparently that happened, you know, after someone came up with the idea, and then all of a sudden there's Paul Rudd. I loved having Mo Collins, you know, who plays Joan Calamezzo, you know, just a quarantine mess. And of course, Pert Hapley. Yeah, I really think they serviced the fans. They really... I just think they nailed it, which, again, they did for 7 years, in my opinion.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and we'll talk about this because let's go back to the beginning a bit.
Yeah.
Now, before we even get into the beginnings of the show, let's talk about your path because you talked about being so happy to end up on a show that will stand the test of time and be that feel-good moment for a lot of people for years and years to come. But what was the journey? How did you get to be in a position to be a part of Parks?
Yeah, well, you know, I was the porn king before Parks. You know, I was the, you know, the big, the guy, you know, when you wanted to watch a good porn with, let's just say, a lot of equipment. You went to me. You went to the Jim O'Hare porn, and yeah, that was it. No, you know, I moved here in '94. So gosh, it'll be 26 years. Oh, how the hell did that happen? But anyway, so, you know, with dreams like everybody, and I moved here with a theater piece, which was great. It opened up a lot of doors. It kind of became this culty kind of show. And next thing you know, agents were calling and managers. And that's the toughest part when you get here is getting any sort of decent representation. And so I had it pretty quick, which was nice. So for many years, I was, you know, they would joke I was like kind of the king of the guest star, you know, because if you look at my IMDb, I've been on a lot of shows over the years, just a lot of shows, you know, guest spot this, guest spot that, a little recurring on this, a little recurring on that, maybe a pilot that, you know, of course, doesn't go anywhere. So then, and believe me, I wasn't complaining. It was lovely. I paid my bills and, you know, it was good. I was the guy that you were like, oh, haven't I seen you somewhere? Where now it's people scream sometimes. It's ridiculous. But, you know, I was out there enough that I was recognizable, which I loved because it meant I was working, you know, and that was good. Mm-hmm. And then the word comes out that Amy Poehler's got a show. You know, she was coming off of SNL. She had just had a baby. And that, you know, NBC was going to do it. And, you know, it was, at the time it was called the Untitled Amy Poehler Project. So, of course, everybody wants in. Everybody wants to read for it. So my people get me in, and I read for Ron Swanson, the role that Nick Offerman did, which, you know, the thought of anybody other than Nick Offerman playing that role, just, it's laughable, you know. But, yeah,
sure.
Yeah, and they always wanted Nick. He was always their guy. But the way the networks work are, no, you got to show us everybody. We got to see, you know, blah, blah, whatever their reasonings are. So I read for Ron Swanson. I gave my version of Ron Swanson. So I think it was like 2 weeks later, I get a call from my agent. They want to see you again for Parks and Rec, again, at the time, Untitled Amy Poehler Project. I'm like, oh, damn, that's awesome. Because my goal for that, even when I went in there the first time, and this is my goal for most auditions, it's tough to get the gig. It really is. There's so many people you're competing against. You don't know ultimately what they're exactly looking for physically, or, you know, the old joke about, oh, you remind the producer of his, you know, his wife's new husband, so he's not going to hire it. You know, a million reasons why you won't get hired.
Right.
But my goal is always to at least kind of nail it in the room, because these people are going to do other shows, and there's going to be guest spots, and there's going to be recurring characters. And if I'm not going to be one of the regulars, I'm happy to drop in, you know, and get the work. And so, and especially for Parks, again, at the time, Untitled Amy Poehler, it was Mike Schur and Greg Daniels from The Office. And I thought, I want to impress these guys because I want them to give me a guest spot later or something. So I get the call for 2 weeks later and they say, you know, they want to see you again. I'm like, wow, I'm shocked. But they said, no, not for Ron, for a guy named Jerry. Are you willing to go in? Well, of course. So I go in, you know, they sent me some sides and I go in and I do it. We have a bunch of laughs because I'm from Chicago, so I knew Carell, and we were, you know, BSing about some Chicago. Anyway, we just had like a really nice session. It was great. And then I read the material and it was good. So then I leave. Now, what I find out later is Greg Daniels said to Mike Schur, he's funny. Put him at a desk. It'll work out. So that's how I ended up getting the gig. Now, at the time, I don't know this. And as a matter of fact, when I got the call, my agent called and said, Jim, you booked this Amy Poehler show. I'm like, oh, my God, you're kidding. What? What am I doing? Because I didn't know. And then she said, Jerry. But she also said to me, and I'm not mad at them for doing this because they were trying to protect me. But she was very honest. She goes, here's what you have to know about this. Because they're being honest with them. They don't know what Jerry's going to be or if Jerry will even be. They have 6 main characters that they have got to service. You know, you got Leslie and Ron and Tom. You have Ann Perkins. You have April. And who would be, is that 5 or 6? Did I say
5? Chris
Pratt. Oh, at the time, Paul Schneider. At the time, Paul Schneider. Yeah.
Gotcha.
So there was your 6. And so they, are just letting us know we don't know what's going to happen with this. There's going to be a lot of times Jim is just sitting at a desk and we don't know. We just don't know. So my agent said, so you really need to think about this because we don't want you to feel like an extra. And believe me, there's nothing wrong with being an extra. But at that point in my career, that would be an odd thing to do. You know, it would be an odd thing to go back to being, I was an extra 100 years ago, but it would be an odd thing to go back to. But for me, it was a no-brainer. This is Mike Schur and Greg Daniels. Look what happened to those ancillary characters on The Office. You're Phyllis and your Kevin and your Meredith and your Stanleys from, you know, Angela's. It was a no-brainer for me. It was absolutely a no-brainer. And so we took the gig, and I was not a series regular the first or the second season. The first season, we only did six, so there was no pilot. And I will say this, and we ended up turning some people away because of the first six, because when you do a pilot, that's when you can figure stuff out. You know, you're like, okay, here's what worked, here's what didn't. We didn't do that. We did six in a row because NBC was so high on it, especially because of Amy. They had Amy. They're like, just shoot six of them. So we did that. But her character, the Leslie Knope character, was coming off a lot like Michael from The Office.
Yeah.
And that was never the intention. And so some people tuned in and they were like, oh, it's an Office ripoff. Nope, not interested. So
do you think there was kind of pressure to make it an Office-like show just because that's sort of what the expectation was?
My understanding is that that's what Mike and Greg were asked to do an Office spinoff. Now, that was my understanding. They'd have to give you the exact details. Mm-hmm. But they didn't want to exactly do that. So they came up with this idea and never meant for Leslie Knope and Michael Scott to be the same person. That was never their intention. But it does come off that, you know, if you watch those first. So as a matter of fact, I will tell people sometimes, which I'm sure I shouldn't do this, but I'll say, listen, start with season two and then go back. Because there's some great stuff in season one that you don't want to miss. But season two, they had figured out who Leslie was. And, you know, she's your lead character. If you're not going to be on board with her, you aren't going to watch, you know, and so anyway, I'm always like season two. So, and then season two, I ended up with an episode, which based on me, my character. And so then I'm like, wow. And I was, at that point, I was still just a, you know, they called it recurring, even though I was in every single episode. But then I think it was, I'm going to say the middle of the season, we got the call that they're going to, you know, they want to negotiate and blah, blah, blah. Next, I remember being in an airport in Miami and my agent called. I was, what the hell I was doing in Miami, but she called and said, we got a call from the show. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm gone. You know, they're getting rid of me. And she goes, they want to make you a series regular. I was like, damn. Yes, 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 yes. So, and they did the same with Retta. Mm-hmm. And now before that, because you know, Chris Pratt wasn't a regular either the first season. And then they made him a regular season two. And then Retta and I officially started season three as regulars.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense because, you know, you alluded to the season two episode that that spotlighted you. And that's the episode we're going to talk about on this show. It's one that you chose actually ahead of time. Yes. It's been a long time since I've seen this one, but it was pretty cool. But this was actually season two, episode 19. So this was far enough along that I guess, to your point, you guys knew you were headed to season three. And it's time to flesh out who this Jerry guy is.
Exactly. So
this was, I thought it was really cool that you picked this one. You know, it's interesting. On this show, a lot of people tend to pick episodes later in the game or, you know, once the show is more further along, I guess, in its path to the fan base really accepting it and it becoming this, you know, big thing, reaching its peak, so to speak. I don't think we were there yet for Parks and Rec in season two. I think people were still very much discovering it.
Yeah.
But definitely when you watch this, you can see the leaps and bounds that the show has already taken beyond season one and, you know, people calling it the Office
spinoff. Yeah.
Yeah. They're really some, you know, some less kind, some more of an Office ripoff.
We heard it all. Absolutely.
Yeah. But I mean, this is in the right direction, certainly, to what you guys were going to be, which is, you know, I would almost call it like the Office's like nicer, kinder, warmer, distant cousin.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I got a lot of crap from the people on the Office who I love. First of all, I was already obsessed with the Office. So I love that show. And I get, you know, when you go, you're on the same network, you end up, everyone ends up at the same, you know, parties and this and that, you know, cause you get, have to go to this and that. So we all became friends. And then when the word got out that I had an episode, season two, I got a lot of crap from them in a loving way. Like, it took me four seasons to have them, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, hey, you know, bring the genius that is Jerry and you too can have a season two episode. But you know, cause they had more characters to deal with than we did. And so just two different shows, but yes, I was very fortunate, but I will tell you the when people say, what are your favorite episodes? You know, I have a million of them, but a lot of them are early on only because, like I'll always say, one of my very favorites is The Hunting Trip. It was season two, I believe. And the reason it was one of my favorites is personal. It's not even about it was a great episode, but it's the fact that it was the first time most of us weren't in the office and we were shooting in the forest somewhere in Los Angeles somewhere. And it's the episode we bonded as people, as human beings, because there was a lot of hanging around outside. And I don't know, I love that episode because when I watch it, it's like, oh God, I feel like this is when we clicked as a cast. I really felt this was when we clicked. So I love that episode. And then of course there's the Jerry episode where we find out who Jerry is when Mark Brandan, I think, who's the comedian was guesting? He played the cop.
Louis C.K.
Louis C.K. Yeah. He was guesting and we did this bit where, we're playing a game on each other or something like that. And I didn't want to play. And it turns out, you know, we were trying to find dirt on each other. And then Mark Brandanowitz at the time, Paul Schneider said, well, I hear you're, or I say to him, oh yeah, I hear you got two unpaid parking tickets, you know, big deal. And he says, yeah, well, I hear your adoptive mother smokes pot. And he can tell I'm all worked up. And he goes, oh, you didn't know she smoked pot? And I go, I didn't know I was adopted. And that's when they were like, that's who Jerry is. That's who he's going to be. Jerry's that guy. And so I love that episode for that, because in my mind, that's when it all came to be for Jerry. So, you know, it all goes. There's all sorts of stuff.
Okay, guys, quick time out here from this fantastic conversation. I'm having a lot of fun, but let's talk about something that is super important. A great organization, No Kid Hungry, is a campaign that is helping kids remain fed each and every day, even when school is not in session. So take a listen to this message and get to know No Kid Hungry.
Because of the coronavirus, schools have closed nationwide, and kids in need are missing nearly 34 million school meals every day. For many, it's the only healthy food they might get in a given day. No Kid Hungry has a plan to feed these kids, but they need your help. Donate now at nokidhungry.org to help feed America's children during this crisis and in the months to come. That's nokidhungry.org. Thanks.
Let's talk about this episode, because there's a part of this episode at the end that I think is another one of those moments, in my opinion, that really defines exactly who Jerry is. But we'll get to it. The episode is called Park Safety, 19th episode again of season two. And this is, I mean, first of all, before we get into it, let's just explain that I think more than any other episode before, this is where we really define Jerry's role in the office as far as being the guy that everybody constantly rags on and makes fun of. What were your feelings like when you first kind of understood this direction for the character?
My feelings were, let's go for it. As it went on and went on, when they realized who Jerry was, Mike would tell you, it got so crazy in the writer's room. Every bit they were coming up with was a Jerry slam. to the point he's like, okay, we're writing a whole show. This can't just be about slamming Jerry, because that kind of stuff is fun to write, you know.
Right.
I love that kind of thing. And the cast members, the other people would have more trouble than I would. Like, I forget which, I mean, a couple of times it happened, but one time in particular, I could picture Pratt going, Jim, are you sure about this one? I feel really bad. I go, dude, it's great. It's brilliant. I'm a comic actor. This is what I live for. And this is who this character is. So let's go. Yeah, I never had a problem with it. And so many people, I'm sure you've read it, they're so mean to Jerry. I feel terrible. And I do appreciate that. That's very sweet. But the show realized once it was, wow, Jerry is, boy, every minute they're at Jerry. Mike said, the only way to keep this character around that will be able to do it is he's got to have the most amazing home life of anybody. He's got to go home and just have it all. And Jerry did. Jerry had it all. He had the beautiful wife. He had the beautiful daughters who just thought he walked on water. And let's face it, he had the big penis. So he had it all. He really did have it all. So it never bothered me. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. There was never one day I thought, oh, I wish there'd be a little less Jerry mocking and stuff. That's who Jerry was. Jerry knew who he was in that office. He also knew, and I believe this, they loved him. They always had his back when it counted, and he certainly loved them. But as much as he loved them, nothing was more important than his family. And I think the episode, I forget what season, I'm thinking six, when Leslie comes to the house and she sees what this is, even though it's crazy, we're singing songs at the breakfast table. I mean, it's all ridiculous. But then I show her some albums of our life, and she gets it. She's like, wow. And she realizes Jerry has it better than anybody. So I think it, I have no problem. That's a long-winded answer to say I loved every minute of it.
Well, I think everyone loved every, you know, as you said, from the writers to everybody working with you. And I think it also gave every other character on the show a chance to be just a little imperfect, to be, just have this side of them where they, yes, you know, they didn't, yes, always have to be nice 24/7. There was one, yeah, guy that just tempted, even, I mean, Leslie Knope is probably as good of a character, just as good hearted of a character.
Yes, yes.
And on TV, but even she could not resist tearing, yeah, into you time and time again. Yeah. And you know, we'll skip to the end here just to make this point, but to your point, the moment I'm talking about in this episode, the very end of it, you know, after all the teasing, everything that goes on in this episode, you say, you know what, it's okay, because, you know, at that time you were predicting a retirement in 2 years.
Yeah.
You get to spend, you know, go home and, you know, just
read,
spend
a book,
your retirement with your wife, your family. Yeah. And that was sort of your mental saving grace. That's what mattered to you more than anything else that anybody could possibly say for 8 hours a day in the office.
Jerry was focused. He knew what was important. He also was okay with the mundane of office work. It was just part of government work, and he was okay with it. That's, yeah, okay. There's people like that.
Yeah. You were just happy to do, you know, do your job.
Yeah.
And, do your time.
Do your time, man.
Finish line in mind, and better things on the horizon. And that's
exactly, absolutely.
But so the episode actually starts, to jump back to the beginning real quick, and we'll thank our friends at fandom.com. They have excellent episode recaps all the way, nice, through the series. But we start off with Leslie holding a drawing to determine who will fill the park's hummingbird feeders. This is apparently something that happens every year as if it's a prize, but it's really not. It's really a chore. Mm-hmm. And apparently for the last 3 years, it's been rigged so that you would win that alleged raffle each and every year, have, yep, to go out and fill those feeders. Very Jerry.
Yes. And they all admit it, you know, to the camera, that they all put their name in, or put my name in rather. So there was no other name that would have come out except Jerry. There was no other way to do it.
Even Leslie Knope.
Even Leslie, who put in multiple names.
Yes.
Jerry. Yes. Not just one, multiple.
So later on, of course, we're back in the office, and Leslie receives a call from Ann Perkins, that Jerry is in the hospital. So we find out that you have a dislocated shoulder, you're kind of beat up, and the story that everyone gets is that you were assaulted, you were mugged, so to speak, during this mission that they sent you on to fill out these feeders, which...
Hummingbird feeders, yes.
Yeah, and so, I mean, we're led to believe that this could be the very first time since you've worked in that office with these people that they've been in a position where they have to show some empathy and kindness to you.
Well, number one, they know I'm only there because of them. Like, so they think I got mugged because, you know, they all cheated. They all put my name in the hat. Mm-hmm. So they have guilt.
And they also had Leslie forcing them to be nice.
Even exactly. Oh, big time. Big time. They had to make a poster, which was horrible. Of course, Leslie, within somehow 10 minutes, had sewn together a pillow and a, you know, the genius that is Leslie Knope can do anything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And now, of course, this becomes a full-scale mission to try to make that area safer, to make... to put more security out there to prevent something like this from happening again. So you become almost like a poster boy for the victims, the potential victims exactly. of this type of situation.
I'm trying to think what they had. I think it was my face with a black eye and it said, this is the picture of failure or something like that, which the point wasn't that I was a failure. The point was supposed to be that, you know, something happened in the parks area and something we failed to protect me. But of course it just comes across as Jerry's just a big failure.
Yeah. And this is, you know, another kind of subtle thing, but if you watch the series through the seasons, these early seasons, they relied a lot more, I think, on those, you know, documentary style shots of people making facial expressions to the camera, the acknowledgement that the camera is there. There's a lot of that in this episode because people are, you know, giving that, can you believe that Jerry has done this? Can you believe this is happening? Just trying to hold in their laughter. That's a big, you know, the character's a big character in this episode.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, if you notice, because they let us do it, they let us choose how often we would or would not refer to camera. Like they never set parameters on that. If we felt we wanted to, we could. I didn't do it a lot. I didn't think Jerry would be that guy because Jerry's not totally, you know, cool and with it. Whereas people like Ben, he looked at it a lot. Oh my gosh, Aubrey, you know, April Ludgate and Pratt. So I didn't do that a lot, but yeah, I love the asides like that when people look to the camera.
Yeah, it's almost the, I guess the idea is almost to make the viewer at home feel like you're sharing a moment of sanity with whoever is choosing to look at you.
Exactly.
Yeah, but certainly not a lot of sanity in this episode, of course.
Next to none.
We've got this full-scale mission, as we said. We're going to try to clean things up, and this brings an interesting guest star that many may not remember, Andy Samberg.
Andy Samberg, yeah.
On this episode, and he plays a park ranger of sorts who I thought this was genius. Like, his notable quality is that he – I guess because he works outside so much, he only really has the outside voice. Like I don't know. Tell my kids.
Well, if you read but if you follow the script, because Leslie knew him from before. He's just always been a loud talker, and now it's only gotten worse as he's gotten older. So he does not have an inside voice. He can't do it. He just can't do it.
Yeah, and you know. I think a lot of people who got to know him on Saturday Night Live, and then, you know, this preceded Brooklyn Nine-Nine. So this was a hint, I think, of what he could do in a
And I think he'll tell you this is what got him interested in wanting to do a sitcom. The park set was, I don't know, I know people say it, oh, it's like a family, and believe me, I've been on a lot of those shows that say it, and I'm like, that ain't what I saw, but it really was amazing on Parks, and I think he thought, this is really cool. I think I need to, this might be a good avenue. And I actually, further down the line, I ended up doing a couple of Brooklyn Nine-Nines, and they had a great set too. And it makes all the difference. It just makes all the difference, especially when you're doing comedy.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, certainly Parks and Rec, a great example of that. Now, before we get to kind of the flipping point of this episode where the big reveal happens, we have Jerry returning to the office, and this is the ultimate, the apex, I guess, of struggle for everyone to treat him with care and with politeness and trying to hold back their usual reactions to him, their usual laughter at him.
Because before I get there, Leslie is telling them, we've got to support him. We have got to be here for him. And then, of course, Tom's like, well, he needs a lot of support, you know, a bra for a man. And then Leslie's like, okay, no, that's it. And then she goes, unless somebody has one more. You know, it was ridiculous.
It's so hard to resist. Nobody can resist. And so you come back, you just ask for, you know, normal treatment. You want to get back to work, get things back to normal. Which means it's time for Jerry to give a presentation and get everybody in a conference room together while you struggle. Now, not only is this Jerry, this is Jerry with a bit of a handicap because you're injured and you're moving around even less nimbly and capably than usual. And,
sweating like a pig.
And we start off with some technical issues with your laptop, and that quickly leads into a barrage of other issues, which ends with you literally tearing your pants and
the fart heard round the world.
Yes, exactly. And everyone just freaking out and struggling so hard, so mightily, not to just tear into you. it was amazing. I mean if there was one scene that could kind of encapsulate everything that was Jerry,
yes,
and the way they felt about it,
and you know, when we were shooting that, because you know the wardrobe department would split the pants, you know, give it a, you know, they'd loosen it so that when you bent over it would split and all that stuff. So at one point Amy was like, oh, okay, I can't laugh anymore, I'm exhausted. I said, in my mind, it was like, oh, that's a challenge. Okay. Yeah. So I went and took my underwear off, because what I was going to do is on the next take, when my pants split, it was just going to be my naked ass. And so right when I'm about to do it, the director yells, cut. And he comes, Jim, he goes, Jim, come here a minute. And I go, and he goes, do you have underwear on? I said, no. And he goes, I heard that. Don't do it. We're going to get in trouble. So anyway, we didn't do it. But I told Amy and she laughed. So in a way, I did get her.
Nice. Unbelievable. Too bad.
Yes, because the world needs to see that.
That could have been a great DVD extra, but not to be. But so Jerry is kind of back in the same role he was in the eyes of everybody, although nobody can say anything about it yet. But things are about to take a turn for the worse. We're about to go to a press conference where we're really going to push this issue of the local government now giving some funds to Leslie to help push some more security out there in the Pawnee world. And this is the point where Jerry has to admit there was not actually a mugging at all. So this
no mugging.
This turns everything around now. All the guilt, all of the empathy. There's no reason for it anymore.
Yes. Should I reveal what happened?
Well, let's see. I think that in that scene that you did tell Leslie everything, which
I whispered to her, I just said, I wasn't mugged. Cut to her, go to commercial. And then when we come back, it's me revealing that I had not been mugged, that I was walking my dog, Lord Sheldon, and I had a breakfast burrito and it fell into a little creek. And I then reached in and fell forward into the creek trying to get the burrito and injured my shoulder because I fell in first. And the dog is just standing there looking at me. All this to get a breakfast burrito.
Yeah, which is so ridiculous and so irresponsible of Jerry to create this lie, to create this fictional story that's caused so much drama. But the explanation is something that everyone can kind of get on board with, because
absolutely
the idea of the abuse that you knew that Jerry knew he would take if that truth came out.
Yes.
And the bonus there is this amazing impersonation that, that Amy Poehler does of Tom, of what he would say, which I can't even begin to even try to do justice, but definitely.
Yeah, I can't either, but it was, what would you do for a Klondike, Jerry? Kill your wife? Yeah, but I can't, you know, that's Amy. That's her gig.
And, you know, for those who watch the series or will be watching the series all the way through at some point, there's a really interesting kind of parallel situation to this, because Jerry, you know, he knows everyone rags on him, but I think the idea is that Tom is probably the worst or one of the worst.
Mm-hmm.
And fast forward a couple, I don't know exactly which season or episode it is, but there comes the point where you're getting, where you're retired, where you've left working there full time every day. And Tom has now become the new Jerry, and everyone,
his greatest fear was happening. Yeah.
And with the idea that every office apparently has a Jerry, you're not there anymore. And it gets to the point where Ron Swanson actually has to bring you back into the office on a part-time basis just to deflect the heat off of Tom so that you can be Jerry again.
Yeah. And dude, let me tell you, as an actor, when you get the episode that says you're retiring, you're like, what the hell? You know, and of course they played it around with me mentally to mess with me for a little while. They said, no, you're back. You're coming back. But I'm like, oh my God, I don't want to leave. But yeah, so Jerry had to come back to just take his place.
Right. That was, you know, it was a great kind of a callback, I guess, to sort of that dynamic that, you know.
And that was the episode I was set on fire. The retirement episode. Yeah.
Of course.
Good
times. Of course. We had to get there at some point. So now the truth is out. Leslie is not revealing this necessarily to everybody, but now Carl comes in, Andy Samberg, who's now angered at this entire situation and feels like he has an axe to grind, and he happens to somehow procure a camcorder version of exactly what happened to Jerry.
And he's pissed because Amy Leslie has gone on the TV to say the Parks Department aren't safe, and she was kind of blaming, you know, his department. So now he's got some evidence.
Yes. And he's going to tell her his nefarious plan very loudly, because he has no other
way to do it. Very loudly.
But somehow they still come up with a somewhat discreet agreement between the two of them. And they end up going on television and not revealing this truth and being able to kind of avoid the whole thing. Leslie gets Carl a new cart for his department, and the secret is safe, which, going back to your point, I think kind of brings up the idea that even though everyone rags on Jerry so much, you know, Leslie took care of you and made sure, you know, it was an embarrassing thing all around, but took care of your secret and tried to.
Yeah, and at the end, she goes, I'm going to delete this. She goes, after I watch it a couple more times.
Yeah, exactly. You know.
Yeah, they really, there's, I can point to, you know, specific instances where they always did have his back. Because again, and I try to, when people are like, oh, they were so mean, I'm like, well, here's where they saved his butt, you know. So, but yeah, that was definitely one of them where Leslie could have totally, you know, called me out in front of everybody, but she did not. That was a secret we kept.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, you know, as we said before, the things wrap up with things going back to normal. You're back in the office. It's open season on Jerry once again. But then we get that great insight that aside from you, that, you know, in the end, there's more important things on the table for Jerry and yeah. More important things to come. And I mean, you're married to Christie Brinkley.
And one of my favorite running gags in the whole show is every time Ben sees her or hears about her, he's like, how did that happen? Was she drugged? Is she in a witness protection program? Like, he just cannot make sense of it.
You know, this wasn't part of this episode, but I have to ask you now. We talked about your reaction in seeing the script, seeing where your character was going at this stage of the game. What was your reaction when you found out that Christie Brinkley was going to be playing your wife?
Well, everything was such a big surprise because the word was out, okay, we're going to need to give Jerry a home life that's different. So what is it going to be? And there were different pitches. Somebody had the pitch that maybe when Jerry went home, it's this like tiny little nervous woman who's chain smoking because when Jerry goes home, he's a tyrant. Like maybe it's okay if we bust on him at work because at home he's just this crazy man and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So then finally Mike, I think it was Mike, came up with, what if we got like a supermodel, you know, a Christie Brinkley type? So that's what they say to me. I'm like, oh my God, this sounds awesome. Who are you trying for? And he goes, well, we won't get her, but we're going to put the word out. So I don't know, a week later, something like that, Mike goes, well, we found your wife. And I go, who? And he goes, Christie Brinkley. I go, what are you talking about? He goes, we got Christie Brinkley. I go, what? So how that happened, I find out later, is Christie Brinkley had never heard of Parks and Recreation, but her daughter was obsessed. So Christie mentions to her daughter, Sailor, who's now a model, they asked me to do this show and it's in a parks or something. And she goes, oh my God, Parks and Recreation? And Christie goes, yeah, I think that's it. And she goes, they want me to play someone's wife. And then Sailor told me later, her brain was like, okay, who's got it? Who's married? Who, you know, and all of a sudden she goes, Jerry's wife. And she goes, yes. And so Sailor was like, mom, you got to do it. Please do it. Please do it. So that's how Christie came on board. And then every time she came and shot, you know, she'd come from New York, Sailor would come with her and hang on the set because she was just a huge fan. So yeah, that's how that happened. I was blown away. Like, how does that happen? That doesn't happen. She's a poster on my room. That doesn't happen. Yeah, it was crazy.
That's amazing.
And she is as sweet as you would expect and an amazing storyteller, and she's been through it. I'm like, you gotta write this, has got to be a book. She has been in helicopter crashes. I mean, she has really been through it, and she's still funny and sweet and loving. I actually saw her last, I think, October. Kate, who played Meredith on The Office, was doing Dancing with the Stars, and Christie's daughter Sailor was doing it. So I was there for Kate. She was there for her daughter. And anyway, we had a little Gurgitch reunion.
Nice. Very nice. well, look, I think what we figured out from this episode is that in the end, the lesson that you can learn from an episode like this, or really Parks and Rec in general, is that it's good to be Jerry or Larry or it Gary is. Or whatever.
Or Terry or Barry, yes. There's five names. I'll answer to any one of them. Yeah, but you're right, it is good. It's and for an actor, you know, there was concern by some, are you worried that you're going to be labeled now and this is, you're always going to be Jerry? And well, yeah, and of course at the time I was like, well, not till you mentioned it, but yeah, now that you're saying it, maybe I should be worried. But I had done a lot of work before Parks, and thankfully I've done a lot of work post Parks, but obviously, you know, unless some strange thing happens in the future, I will be known, you know, my acting work will mostly be known as Jerry from Parks, and I'll wear that with a badge of honor.
That's great. That's great. And, you know, as you say, the show is just getting more and more popular. So, yeah. You Wild. Know, more and more people will be discovering the legend of Jerry.
The man, the myth, the legend, the penis. Yes.
there's a t-shirt.
Yes, yeah, there you go, you're right.
I don't want to be the graphic designer for it, but somebody would be able to take that shot.
Jim,
it's been great. It's been
this
great
was
having
fun. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. And can't wait to to get this episode out and to have everybody check it out. And, you know, you guys are listening to it now. So thank you so much for joining us. And Jim, thank you so much as well, man. It's
been my pleasure. Stay safe, everybody. Put a damn mask on your face. Thanks.
Right. Bye-bye. Have a great night. Bye.
You too.
Guys, thank you again and again and again for joining us on the Laugh Track. We appreciate you being here. We appreciate you following us and sharing and spreading the word, and we want to keep the ball rolling. The Laugh Track, of course, produced by me, Jerry Strauss, with additional Major League production by our maestro, Steve Prentice, our friend who does all the heavy lifting here on this show. And of course, if you want to hear more of our show, make sure you check out our website. LaughTrackPod.com is your one-stop shop for episodes old and new, as well as our free mailing list and links to all of our social media and many of the outlets where you can hear the show. We're on Apple, we're on Spotify, we are on Google, we're everywhere, man, and you can be too. So make sure you subscribe wherever you'd like so you can get the latest episodes as soon as they are released each and every week. Of course, social media, we're all over it, man. Instagram. We have an account that you can and should follow at Laugh Track Pod. Twitter, follow us there at Laugh Track TV. And of course, our Facebook group is growing and popping off, if you will. Is that what the kids say? You can check us out there and please join us at facebook.com/groups/Laugh Track Pod. Until next week, I'm Jerry Strauss. For Steve Prentice, this is the Laugh Track.